Exodus is the title that's given to this book in the Masoretic text and in the Septuagint. The Hebrew title is just the first several words. Now, these are the names. Believe it or not, that's the Hebrew title for the book. And it could be written, "And these are the names." Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy all begin with that word "and" that's translated now here. Because as Moses wrote, this was a continuation in his mind. And the very title of the book is interesting in the Hebrew. It's just, "And these are the names." He just takes those first few words, and that is what titles this section of the Pentateuch, of the law, as he wrote it. Exodus is a fitting name because certainly it's a book of redemption and of the children of Israel coming out of bondage and out of Egypt. Very amazing record without any shadow of a doubt. Now, authorship is something that people who sit around in ivory towers have lots of time to argue about. We don't. Jesus says in Matthew 12:26 and a number of places that Moses wrote Exodus. And if Jesus thought he wrote it, we don't need to go any further. The scholars can argue the Lord of glory said Moses wrote it. So we're happy with that. There are a number of places in the Gospels where he ascribes Exodus to Moses. It begins by saying, "Now these are the names of the children of Israel which came into Egypt. Every man and his household came with Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. And all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all of his brethren, and all of that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them." And by the way, in verse 7, there's a Hebrew grammatical construction. The way he keeps saying and is a grammatical way of making emphasis that all of these things were very prominent, that they were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty. And the land was filled with them, just as the promises had been made. It was God spoke to Abraham, said, "Your descendants will be like the sand of the sea," and so forth. Said those things to Isaac, reiterated them to Jacob, promised them to Joseph, Joseph to his son. So the word of God being fulfilled here exactly as he said it would. Verse 8 now brings us to a juncture where it says, "Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph." Now, we're a little over 300 years after Joseph has passed off the scene. Genesis 15 said that they would be down in Egypt to the fourth generation, 400 years, and they would be afflicted there. We have the same word used here in the first chapter of their affliction. We have a very interesting sequence of events, and it's hard to be dogmatic about these things. If you go to the University of Pennsylvania or you go to different libraries trying to track Moses and the children of Israel in Egypt and then their exodus, you find very little recorded because, like the Phoenicians and like the Assyrians and the Babylonians, these cultures never recorded their defeats. So there would be no in-depth record of Moses, used by God in a miraculous way, judging the deities of Egypt, and that's what each judgment was, and then defeating the entire army in the sea. We don't find those kinds of records because those cultures only recorded their victories and not their defeats. We do find, and when we actually get to the passing of the Red Sea and the Exodus, We'll mention some. We do find inscriptions in the Sinai, though, that are little spoken of, that speak of the Red Sea parting and so forth. In the Sinai, where we're going to find out Moses' father-in-law was, his name was Reuel, or friend of God, and he was priest of Midian. Midian was one of the sons of Abraham from Keturah, the wife that he took after Sarah died. So there was, in the area of Sinai, a group of Bedouins that were monotheistic and believed in El Shaddai. And amongst their inscriptions and writings, we do find record of the children of Israel passing through the Red Sea. The best we can do is piece some things together here in the first chapter. Now, during the time that Joseph was alive and reigning with Pharaoh in Egypt, that seems to be early in the 13th dynasty. His name, Zaphnath-Paneah, is relative to some of the names of pharaohs, and some of the priests of On have the Paneah, those parts of the name, then, as Moses, Amos, and some of the kings in the later dynasties when he was on the scene, seem also his name is common in that era. There is a blank in Egyptian history from the fourth king of the 13th dynasty all the way to the 18th dynasty. There really is no records. And it is a time that scholars have to deal with this strange dynasty called the Hyksos dynasties. There was a group of invaders that came into Egypt. They are called the Shepherd Kings or the Hyksos Kings. And they came in and they subdued Egypt from the fourth king of the 13th dynasty all the way to the 18th dynasty, several hundred years, and they ruled over Egypt. They came in with chariots, they came in with force. It said they almost took the land without a battle. And these Hyksos kings, these shepherd kings, seemingly were tolerant of the children of Israel because they also were shepherds. You remember Joseph had to eat at a separate table because it says the Egyptians held shepherds as an abomination, wouldn't even eat with them. Well, it seems that whoever these kings were, God raised them up, God brought them in, because during their reign there was some great construction in the Delta area. And it was during that era that the children of Israel grew into a nation. They will be called the people of God, no longer just now by names, but now they're becoming a nation. And they've learned agriculture, they've learned writing, they've learned some science and some geometry, some remarkable things there in Egypt as they become a nation. It seems then in the 18th dynasty, a king, Ames, comes to power again, and this is the king that knew not Joseph. It seems that we have an Egyptian dynasty once again in the 18th dynasty taking over. He has a successor, Thutmose II. Thutmose II has a wife, Hatshepsut. You'll remember all this. And you'll see why I'm giving you this. Thutmose II dies, possibly in the Red Sea. He passes off the scene mysteriously. He has no direct son that we know of, possibly because the angel of the Lord went through Egypt and slew the firstborn. His wife, Hatshepsut, becomes Pharaoh, a female ruler in Egypt, and actually proclaims herself to be deity, and some of the huge statues that she built, and she had a remarkable reign for over 20 years. There was peace, there was great prosperity and building. She actually portrays herself sometimes with the beard that was only allowed to be put on the statues for the kings and for the gods. Her stepson, Thutmose III, when he comes to power, hates her and kills her. And he goes on a rampage up into Canaan land. Now, it's interesting because when Hatshepsut is queen of Egypt, all the mining in Sinai stops. There was, at that point in time, some great fear of the area of Sinai, and no doubt because God had destroyed the armies of Pharaoh in the Red Sea, and that's where the children of Israel had gone. Well, Thutmose II, when he comes to power, does not know, because it's only an 11-day journey from Egypt to Sinai. It's a shame that it took them 40 years. It's only an 11-day journey. The scripture says that. Thutmose III thinks that the children of Israel have gone into Canaan. He doesn't know they made a right and they're wandering around in Sinai. So Thutmose III goes up into Canaan and wreaks havoc for years, destroying the Hittites and the Phoenicians and the civilizations that are there. And by the time the children of Israel come to Canaan 40 years later, they are small kingdoms drawn into cities like Jericho and so forth, walled cities to protect themselves. And the unified power of the era has been broken. And by the time they come, the children of Israel, the Canaanites are scared to death of them because Thutmose III came up and gave them a whooping. And they figure, he beat us, and if they beat him, we're in trouble because now here they come. So they say, Madam, we're in trouble now. It's in the ancient inscriptions. So, you know, behind the scenes, there's this incredible, incredible working. Because the defeats were so dramatic, those things are not recorded in detail. But we are finding more and more evidence of these things. The point is that God was fast at work when things looked bleak and things looked dark, as He is today. And in one sense, I'm excited as I see our nation on a downward slide, because Isaiah says that when darkness comes in like a flood, that the Lord will raise up a standard. As He did then, as He will now, He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. They are multiplying. They are growing. And a Pharaoh arose who knew not Joseph. Verse 9, this Pharaoh said unto his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Now we know from the first count in Numbers that there's 600,000 fighting men above the age of 20. So if there's 600,000 men of that age, by the time you take into consideration younger men, older men, children, and wives, we are between 2 and 3 million people coming out in the Exodus. He said, they are greater and mightier than we are. Come on, let us, notice, deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us. And so get them up out of the land. Now, this is probably Ammies, this first pharaoh, Egyptian pharaoh, to retake the area. He's afraid because the Hyksos kings were tolerant of the children of Israel, that if they don't bring them into subjection and deal with them, that if another war begins, that they might fight on the side of their enemies and then be able to leave the land. Now they are using them for forced labor, and we're going to look at that. You know the story. You can get the movie and borrow it from the tape lending library. And we do have in ancient Egyptian inscriptions that in this era of the 18th dynasty, that the Fenchu, F-E-N-C-H-U, were used as forced slaves. The word Fenchu in Egyptian means the bearers of the shepherd's staff. So no doubt this is that era under Ammies as he comes into power again. He says, let's deal wisely with them, unless this turns to a problem. Therefore, verse 11, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities in Pithom and Ramesses. Now, Ramesses was a name that was around since the 13th dynasty. A king would take that name. We hear of Ramesses, but... And the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. Now, by the way, in some way, you have to understand, this is also serving the purposes of God. You know, they are coming under affliction. One thing that happens under their affliction is they then begin to turn to and cry out upon the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. which probably in many ways had been set aside. We will see a Hebrew beating a Hebrew in the next chapter, imitating their captors. We know that when the angel of death goes through Egypt, that the doorposts and the lentils of the Hebrews are marked with blood to distinguish them from the houses of the Egyptians. So some of them were intermingled to a degree. But the affliction largely at this time when they would come out in the Exodus and be a nation, this affliction allowed by God forced them to be a separate people and forced them once again to begin to cry to this God that Joseph had believed in, and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, that had caused him to leave his coffin there in Egypt. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick and all manner of service in the field, and all their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor. Now, by the way, how many of you were not here this morning? Just get an idea. Okay. Egypt is a type of the world. Satan is a type of the devil as we go through this. Moses, a type of Christ in many ways, in that he's the deliverer. And Egypt is polytheistic. They have many gods, but they're all related to their natural resources, to the River Nile and so forth. And Egypt is a type of the world in that it is self-dependent, never looking to heaven. Deuteronomy, and you don't have to turn there, chapter 11 says this: "For the land whither thou goest to possess it is not as the land of Egypt from whence ye came out, where thou sowest thy seed and waterest it with thy foot as a garden of herbs. But the land whither ye go to possess it is a land of hills and of valleys, and drinketh the water of the rain of heaven, a land which the Lord thy God careth for. The eyes of the Lord thy God are always upon it." There is clear dependence put upon the children of Israel that in Egypt they sat on these little bicycle type things with pedals and pedaled, and it drew buckets of water up and dumped them in their irrigation canals. And they never looked to heaven. They didn't depend on the rain. Egypt, Mitzarim, with the biblical name for them, has to do with the greenery on both sides of the Nile, and it was related to the river and the irrigation. God says to his people, the place that I want to bring you into is a place that is dependent upon heaven. Egypt, a type of the world, is dependent upon the natural abilities of man and everything that man can do, and the wealth of man and the pleasure of man. The place that God wants to take you and I to, the place where he wants us to walk and live, is a place that drinks the water of the rain of heaven, that we would be dependent on God for our refreshment and for our nourishment. And God clearly says there to the children of Israel, if you worship me and you walk with me and you keep my statutes, the rain of heaven will come and your crops will be blessed and so forth. But if you turn away and you serve other gods, then you'll dry up and the heavens will become like brass and so forth. And you may know that experience. If you are calling yourself a Christian and you're living in deliberate sin, you know what it's like sometimes to get on your knees and feel like your prayers just fall to the floor and they're not going anywhere, because God is waiting for you to come to him in repentance. And God will take this people and bring them to a much different place where they are dependent upon the blessings of heaven, not self-sufficient like Egypt, which is a type of the world. So they now are beginning to serve with rigor. And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of one was Ziphrah, and the name of the other was Puah. I always think you'd do your daughter a favor by naming her Puah. Isn't it interesting that the Lord takes a note of the names of these two women that would have lived in obscurity we've never heard of because of their exercise of faith? Pharaoh said, "When you do the office of the midwife to the Hebrew women, and you see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then you shall kill him. And if it be a daughter, then you shall she shall live. Now, when you see them upon the stools, Jeremiah 18:3 is the only other place in the Bible that uses this phrase, and there it speaks of the stone on the potter's wheel. And it actually speaks of the clay as it's being formed in the potter's hand. And I'm not sure if this, and nobody's really sure, is this speaking about the fact that they actually, when they went to give birth, they actually sat on a round stone that in the environment they were working in the field, that was the cleanest place they had, like the potter's wheel. Or are they talking about that God views life as it issues forth from the womb, that he sees his own creation, the work of his hands? We don't know, but it says, as you see them upon the stool, speaking like we do, and the only other place in the Bible is the clay upon the wheel. When you see them upon the stools, and you see that the baby, as it's coming out of the birth canal, is a male, put that baby to death. Doesn't that sound a lot like our own government today? Animosity towards believers. Little regard for human life. Self-dependent instead of on its knees looking to heaven for the blessings that God would bring. He said, when you see them give birth, if it's a male child, snap the neck, put the baby to death before they know what has happened. If it's a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God, and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said unto them, why have you done this thing and have saved the men children alive? And the midwives said unto Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively and are delivered before the midwives even can come to them. Now, we don't know how much truth is in this. I'm sure there was some truth in it because the Hebrew women were out working. The Egyptian women were sitting at home watching the Shopping Channel, putting on makeup, you know, just in luxury, soap operas. The Hebrew women were busy. They were in hard labor. Even today, there are Bedouin women that give birth right in the field, and within a day and a half are expected to be back in the field working. The American Indians often would stop, get right off of the horse, hold on to a tree root or a branch, give birth to the baby, pick it up, wrap it, get back on the horse, and keep going. You've come a long way, baby. So maybe there's a certain amount of truth in this, and maybe they're saying, look, let's just take our time when we hear there's a baby being born. You know how lively those Hebrew women are. And by the time we get there, we can tell Pharaoh the truth. Hey, by the time we get there, the babies are already born. But in this exercise of faith, God blessed them. It says that. Therefore, God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he also made them households. And then Pharaoh charged, notice, all his own people, no longer the Hebrew midwives, but now his own soldiers, his own people, saying, every son that is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. Now, by the way, this is the same maniacal influence that we see prophesied in Genesis 3:15, that God would put enmity between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. We see Satan trying to corrupt humanity before the flood. We see Satan once again here trying to destroy all of the male children in the house of Israel. We see it with Esther there and Haman. We see it in Bethlehem of Judea when Herod sends to slaughter all of the innocents. And we see it in Auschwitz and Dachau and Buchenwald, and that Satan has always had a hatred for the people of God, whether it's the church or the nation of Israel. That anti-Semitism is satanic, and so is the persecution of the church. Now, in this dark background, chapter 2 says this. Now there went a man of the house of Levi and took a wife of the daughter of Levi. Now this is Amram and Jochebed, we find out in chapter 6. And the woman conceived, and she bare a son. And when she saw him, that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. Now, we're not sure what this means. It's mentioned, again, in your own reading. You should be reading Acts chapter 7, because Stephen reiterates the history of Moses there and gives us several details we don't have here. And in Hebrews chapter 11, around verses 23 to 27, we also have a God's perspective of the faith of Moses and his parents given to us there. She sees this son. There is something about him that sets him apart even by his appearance. Regardless of the fact that they know in their heart it's wrong to take the lives of their children, this son has an aura about him. This is a special child. She takes him and hides him for 3 months. I don't know if she dresses him up in pink, makes him look like a little girl. I don't know what she does. But, you know, for 3 months now, she hides him. Isn't it interesting, too, because people will say, gee, you know, we see prophecy being fulfilled. We see trouble in the Middle East. We see all of these things going on in our world. Should we still have children? Should we have them? Have them. Moses was born in this kind of an environment. Noah had 3 sons while he was building the ark, waiting for the world to be destroyed. Would to God that they'd be given to us instead of to worldly people who won't care for them or will have them aborted. Have them. Moses born in a bleak and dark time because of the faith of his parents. Very interesting, too. His mom, Jochebed, is the first name in the Bible we have that is compound with Jehovah. Up until this time, we have no evidence that anybody knew about Jehovah. It was El Shaddai that had revealed himself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The YHWH seems that the Lord in that capacity as Yahweh, the covenant-keeping God, reveals himself to Moses at the bush, and yet his mother is a compound name, Joel, from the Jehovah, Chabed. It seems that somewhere this mother and father are touched with some understanding of this God that would keep a covenant and one day keep bring them out of the land of Egypt. We don't know. We're not given the details. Very interesting, though. When she could no longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. And his sister stood afar off to see what would be done. Now, she takes it and she daubs it with pitch. It's a little boat. The word ark here is the same word used for Noah's ark, not the word used for the Ark of the Covenant. It is a little boat-like coffin. And she takes that and weaves it of bulrushes and then daubs it with asphalt, with bitumen and slime so that it would be waterproof, puts a lid on it, and then she takes it. In one sense, she's half listening to Pharaoh by casting her son into the water, but she puts it says, amongst the flags. Now, she doesn't just sail it out into the water. She puts it amongst the flags where it would be there, not able to just be carried away with the current. And maybe she knows this is the area where Pharaoh's daughter comes to bathe. We're not sure. She sends Miriam, who's Moses' older sister, about 10 years old probably at this time, sends Miriam to watch. Now, I've got an 8-year-old daughter. I can't imagine what it would do to her if Kathy and I had a small baby at home, 3 months old or so, and that we had to take that child and put that child to try to spare its life into a little ark and put it out into the river, how it would break her heart. And I'm sure that Jochebed, as she places this little craft into the water, saying a quiet prayer, God Almighty, if you're really there. And how this little girl walking along the side of the river is watching to see what will take place. His sister stood there to see what would be done. Now, God's involved, okay? The daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river. So she was walking around. All of a sudden, she thought, I feel yucky, this humidity, Nile. I need a bath. I smell a little bit. So God puts that on her mind and sends her down to the river. I like this. God's involved in everything. Sends her to take a bath right when this little ark is put there amongst the flags and the bulrushes to wash herself by the river. And her maidens walked along by the river's side. When she saw the ark amongst the flags, the reeds, she sent her maid to fetch it. Now we have a very interesting passage in Psalm 78 that talks about the wondrous things that were done in Zoan. Avarim, which is the part of the Nile Delta that the Hyksos were involved in, and it's the only part of the Delta that's not infested with crocodiles, very interestingly. And this is the place where he's placed in the river and where Pharaoh's daughter comes to bathe. And her maidens fetched this for her, and when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept. Notice, she had compassion on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Now, one author said, right before she opened the lid, an angel pinched Moses so that when she opened it, he was going, wah! Tears are running down his face. You know, if she'd opened it and he had just gone, goo, 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 you know, she might have said, oh, it's a Jewish baby. But we don't know. But because she opened the lid and it says he was weeping, her heart was moved with compassion. And I look at this and I think, here is the remarkable thing, the thread of God's sovereignty in his work. That in the tear of a little baby running down his face, the history of Israel, the Messiah, and the church, and you and I this evening, are there pulling on the heart of Pharaoh's daughter to take this child to her home and raise it up. Satan, of course, being outsmarted. Pharaoh had said, let us do wisely and bring these people under hard bondage. Pharaoh is so wise that he ends up paying Moses' mother to nurse him and then raising the deliverer in his own house. I love it when a plan comes together. The baby is weeping. She is moved with compassion. Now, Josephus tells us, and we don't know how true, Josephus is accurate in much of his writing, that Pharaoh's daughter tried to nurse the baby amongst the Egyptian women, but he continued to turn his face away and would not nurse from an Egyptian woman. And that is when Miriam, Moses' sister, stepped into the picture and said, do you want me to fetch? Look in verse 7. Then said his sister to the Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee? Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, go. And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, take this child away and nurse it for me. Moses' mom said, if I have to, and I will give thee wages. Oh, okay, I guess I will. And the woman took the child and nursed it. Now, it's very interesting. We have discovered in the ancient Egyptian ritual for the dead, revered by those in Egypt, part of the passage says that all disembodied spirits must confess in the afterlife to the Lord of truth these three things. I have not afflicted any man. I have not made a man to weep. And I have not withheld milk from the mouth of a sucking child. Isn't that interesting? God had been setting this thing up for a long time. Hatshepsut, the daughter of Pharaoh, gives Moses to his own mother to nurse and pays her to do the job. Now, I am sure for Amram and Jochebed, now as they have this little boy at home, as other male children are still being put to death, that they certainly see him at this point as borrowed. You know, I think initially with our children, we forget sometimes that we're just stewards. They're all borrowed. They're really the Lord's. They're given to us to be stewards over. But when one is taken away from you, and their life is hung in the balance before your eyes, and they're given back, there's a great sense. This one is borrowed, temporary. And if you're a parent here and you can think to those crises in your own life, I think of Joshua the night that he almost died, 4.5 years old. How terrible. Bleeding his life out in front of us, not knowing if he's going to live. I think of Joanna disappearing at the mall once. We thought she was stolen. We're running around like maniacs. You know, Kathy was saying, I thought you had her. I was saying, what do you mean I had her? You had her. You know, and you know, it's one of those heart attack moments because kids get stolen. No kid. We lost our kid, you know, and running around and finding her, then talking to a policeman. I don't know where my parents are. They're lost, you know, kind of a thing. So Mikey was always the guy that was sliding out the car door. You know, 3 times, I think, we hear this noise as we're making a turn and look, and he's hanging on the seat and the car door's open looking at us. And you're laughing, you know, your parents, but you have those experiences and you realize, you know, it is just the mercy of God and their guardian angels that keep them alive till adulthood. It is amazing that they live. And particularly when one is taken away from you and you've given it up in your heart and then it's handed back, no doubt Amram and Jochebed had a great sense of the temporary custody they had of this young man. And he remained with them until he was weaned, which was somewhere between 3 and 5 years old in that culture. And in those years, Amram and Jochebed talked to this little boy about Adam and the creation of the world and about Abel and Cain and about Enoch and Noah and the flood and Seth and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, and how the family had come to Egypt, and that there was a promise that a deliverer would come. Josephus tells us, and of course, again, it's extra biblical, we don't know, there was actually a prophecy that Moses was so beautiful as a child that there was a scribe in Egypt that said to Pharaoh, this is the one that was prophesied, and tried to convince Thutmose II to kill him when he was little. He was so beautiful, tradition says he learned so fast in their schools and universities that everybody was astounded at him. We don't know that. But we do know that they inbred into this young heart, and a child, their learning curve from birth to 3 or 4 years old is tremendous. It increases on a parabola that they took great time to speak to this young boy about the things of God. Now, you're a grandparent, you're a parent, don't ever forget that. While they're little, they watch you. You can come to church and play church. You go home and you're drinking, carry on, fist fighting, compromising, watching pornography. They're not going to learn who God is. Because more is caught than taught. And they will be what you are, not what you say. They will be what you do. And they will have enough understanding to say, Mom's God is real, Dad's God is not real. I want to know Mom's God. And as grandparents, don't ever underestimate the power that you have in the life of your grandchildren, besides the fact that you can come, hang out with them, make them crazy, and then leave and go home and get even with your kids. His mother took him and nursed him. How amazing God is. And the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter when he was weaned. And he became her son, and she called his name Moses. And she said, because I drew him out of the water. Now, by the way, Moses is the name that the Egyptian princess gave to him. We do not know his Hebrew name. We don't know the name that Amram and Jochebed gave to him when he was born. We have no record of it. We know that Pharaoh's daughter named him Moses. M-O, water, from the Egyptian, and the S-E-H-E, to draw out from, Moisha, or Moses, is a Hebrew transliteration of the Egyptian word that was given to him for a name. So we have today his Egyptian name, Moses. I'm not sure. When we get to heaven, we're going to find out what his real name was. Jaime or something. We don't know. We'll find out when we get there what his real name was. Moses. Isn't it amazing? And by the way, if you do borrow the movie, Charlton Heston, you know, you have to get past that, you know, but there is a fair amount of research in the putting together of the film. We are again told by Josephus that at 40 years old, Moses went and defeated the Ethiopians, who had made an inroad into Egypt and brought fear amongst the Egyptians, because it hadn't been that long since they recovered from the Hyksos. And that without understanding, they didn't know how to defeat them. And Moses was called in at 40 and took on the campaign as a general in the Egyptian army and brought about a great defeat of the Ethiopians. That's why in the beginning of the movie you see the Ethiopians brought into the court of Pharaoh, because Moses had just come back from that battle, which evidently is a historical reality. Stephen, when he is about to be stoned, says this, that Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and notice he was mighty in words, a great orator, and he was mighty in deeds. And when he was a full 40 years old, it came to his heart to visit the children of Israel, his brethren, and seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him, he avenged him that was oppressed, and smote the Egyptian. For he supposed that his brethren, and this is very important, would have understood how that God by his hand should deliver them, but they understood not. So Moses at 40 years old has some sense that he has his lot with the children of Israel and not with Egypt. Hebrews chapter 11 says he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And Josephus says because Hatshepsut had no son of her own, that he was actually being groomed to be Pharaoh in Egypt. And tradition says even as a little boy, 5 or 6 years old, that when Pharaoh's daughter introduced him to Pharaoh and brought him from the home of Jochebed, that in a gesture, Pharaoh put his crown on Moses' head as a little boy, and tradition says he took it and put it on the ground and stamped on it. He's a full 40 years old now. He has a sense that his life is to be involved with the children of Israel. It says that, verse 11. It came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out unto, notice, his brethren and looked on their burdens. Notice, he spied an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, one of his brethren. And he looked this way and that way, like us. He saw that nobody was watching. And he slew the Egyptian, and then he hid him in the sand. Praise God, the deliverer is here. He's going to kill Egypt one man at a time. One down, 4 million to go. You know, Moses is going to be used to a degree that the whole world will know of this man's life. And the things that will be accomplished through him, not by him, will be so dramatic that God has to do an incredible work in him. It says at this point, he went out. It doesn't say he was sent out. He goes out to see the situation. He has a sense that he's attached to the children of Israel. He has a sense somehow that he's to be their deliverer. We're not told how. He has a sense that it's greater riches to suffer with the reproach of Christ, the Messiah, than to enjoy the treasures of Egypt. He has a sense that he had rather suffer than have the pleasures of sin for a season. His motivation and his perspective is correct, And yet he goes at this problem with all of his own abilities, all of Egypt's learning. He is taught in all the wisdom of Egypt, but not in the wisdom of God. He had not yet met this God that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had spoken of. We have no record of God appearing from the time that he appeared to Jacob until the burning bush. It was a period where we have no record that God appeared to anyone. Joseph, as we studied his life, never had a personal appearance of God that we have record of. So Moses, though he has a sense of what is right and of God's calling, and he wants to move ahead, he wants to serve the Lord, he wants to be involved in the kingdom, yet at this point, you know, he does it in his flesh, he does it in his own ability, he kills this Egyptian, and then he tries to bury him in the sand. And when he went out the next day, behold, now I don't know if he's feeling pretty good about himself as a deliverer now, he goes out the next day, and then he saw two men, but they were both Hebrews, striving with one another. He said unto them, to the one that did wrong, the one who started this fight, wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? And he said to Moses, who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killest the Egyptian? And Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. Now Moses is afraid because the church knew about it. Once word gets out in the church, everybody's going to know about it. They found out because when he defended the Hebrew the day before and got into the contest with the Egyptian, the man that was being beat no doubt got up and ran away, and Moses killed the Egyptian. The guy that was getting beat went back to the Jews and said, I don't know what Moses is doing. Maybe he got hit in the head, but all of a sudden he's on our side. Moses said, well, surely they're going to understand I'm the deliverer. It tells us that in Acts 7. Here I am. Big D on his chest. I'm here. But he wasn't ready to be the deliverer until he would say, who am I that I should go? He wasn't ready to be the deliverer until we change went, Moses went, to Moses was sent. And there's a big difference. He had the right idea, but the wrong person was in charge. He was in charge. It had to be God who was in charge. And God did not need his help to kill Egyptians. He would kill the entire Egyptian army in the sea without help from Moses and bury them all in the sand. But vengeance belongs to the Lord and not to Moses. Moses would simply be the instrument whereby God would do his work. And it would be his right to wreak vengeance on Egypt, not Moses' right. He had no right to take life. So yes, Moses was the deliverer, but he was not ready to deliver. He had much to learn about the God whom he would serve. And he had much to learn about the power that he would walk in, that it was nothing of Egypt. It was nothing of natural ability. He wouldn't deliver Egypt, the children of Israel, because he was a general and had victory over the Ethiopians. None of those things would come to play. Moses was afraid, and it says, when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. It took God 40 years to get Moses sitting down by this well. Moses now goes to Midian. You know the story. It will be there that he will fall down by a well, at least that's what Charlton Heston did, and he would wake up and the seven daughters of Jethro are there at the well, and there's some other shepherds that are meanies who try to chase him away to water their sheep, and Charlton Heston jumps up with the staff and fights them and drives them away, and all the daughters are going, oh, you know. You know, and as we read the Bible, you know that's where Eliezer found Rebekah by the well. You know, the well seems like a good place to meet for single people, to meet each other. Maybe that's why Jethro, their father, has seven daughters every day. He says, go to the well, go to the well. I don't know. Jethro, Ruel, his other name, friend of God, is called the priest of Midian, a monotheist, who will find out, yes, Moses is dressed like an Egyptian, walks like an Egyptian. Some of you understand. but he's really a Shemite. Same bloodline. Seventh generation from Abraham. Same family. But God now has him at Midian. Midian means strife. It means wrestling. God takes him to that place. Yes, he wants to be used, but he is not ready to be used. He is ready to do it himself. God has to take all of the starch out of him. And this course in the desert is a mandatory course. He had taken a lot of electives in the universities in Egypt. No doubt archery, chariot racing, geometry, architecture, medicine, mysticism. But those who would serve God face the school of God. And there are mandatory courses that are not electives. You don't choose them. You find yourself in the middle of them. And in that school is where you learn to be alone with God. You see, God had removed everything familiar from Moses but one thing, and that was himself. And Moses is there in the desert, the Hebrew word meaning to speak. And God speaking to him there. And it is the same course that would be taken by so many in the scripture. David would be driven to the cave of Adullam. And there God would begin to build the man and build an army to be with him. There he would sit alone and write, "One thing have I desired of the Lord, and that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, that I may behold the beauty of the Lord and inquire in his temple." It would be the same place that God would take Samson to, a man who never had to be led by anyone, who would finally say to a small boy as he was blind, "Take me by the hand and lead me between the pillars." It's the same place that John the Baptist would be taken to, in the desert, in the wilderness, where everything would be removed but God himself. Where Paul would be taken to after his conversion into Arabia for a number of years. Where John would be taken to in the Isle of Patmos, banished alone to receive the greatest revelation of his life. And it would be in the desert, that lonely place. And if you're in a desert experience tonight, and as Christians we use that terminology, "I'm having a desert experience." You know, I've kind of come to like the desert myself. You know, I think when we first have what we call a desert experience, we're all freaked out. When I hear people are having a desert experience, I think that's great. Because the desert is prescribed by God. And there are certain things that are only learned in the desert that are not learned anywhere else. And it's not a punishment or a banishment. It's continued training. And there are wells there. You will discover that there's a well in Midian and strife and a wrestling. And it is a well to drink from. And it is a well to see your reflection in and realize who you are in and of yourself and who you might be with God. And Moses there would discover, because he wasn't the man yet that he needed to be. He certainly was the chosen vessel. But he was not yet the man who would put his pen to the page and write, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was a form and void. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the deep." He was not yet the man that would write the history of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who would record for us the Exodus and his own life. He wasn't yet the man who would write the book of Leviticus and give us the law of God, the book of Numbers, Deuteronomy. But he would become that man. And as we study his life, what remarkable things God will do with this man.